يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello, and welcome to another special Middle East Analysis, where we are picking up with the bid for Palestinian statehood at the UN that's been on everyone's minds for the last few weeks. I'm joined by Dr. Harry Hagopian, who I omitted to say last time was the bishop's consultant on the Middle East region. Apologies for that, Harry. And a great many other things as well, and you can check back through and see all Harry's monikers. But how are you today, Harry?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm as stressed out as you are. It's only Monday and we're both already tired.
Don't give the game away. People can't see us, fortunately. Okay, right, let's pick this up, Harry. Now, we had on the 23rd of September, we heard from Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority. You speculated a bit about the political manoeuvrings and what the ultimate end goal might be of making a bid at the UN for being recognised as a full member state. Now, did it go according to how you thought it would? Bring us up to speed on the state of play.
James, it went halfway according to my plan. If you remember, pre the submission of the bid at the United Nations, I said that two things might happen. One, the US might not need to exercise its veto eventually in the Security Council if 9 out of the 15 members were to vote against the bid. And that is something that is still ongoing, and it is becoming clearer day in, day out that that might actually be the scenario which would spare a US veto and therefore spare the political blushes of the U.S. administration in terms of vetoing down a resolution that pretty much subscribes to the policies not only of President Barack Obama, but of previous American presidents as well. So on that one, I was okay.
But when you talk about Obama, it was a pretty, I think, surprisingly pro-Israel speech in some ways. I think people knew the direction it might go. For a man that said not 12 months before that we should have Palestinian state within 12 months now, it's still
not only
there.
That, but a man who also said that the settlements should stop, and that's it. Yes, I mean, he's backtracked enormously, and the reason he's backtracked and his address to the UN General Assembly was at the very least politically robust, if not vigorous, was because he is going into election mode. And there is the election for his second term. The economy is not doing well at all in the United States, and therefore he needs every vote if he's to be re-elected. And I was doing an interview with another channel, James, and they asked me basically, do you think he would still get in for a second term? And my guess there again, and it is a guesstimate at this stage because we've still got quite a few long months ahead of us, is that he might, but not so much because of his own political brilliance, but rather because of the weakness and the divisions within the Republican Party.
If I was going to be a cynic, I might say because of Osama bin Laden, but hey, that's cynical.
You know what? I think that's cynical, and Osama bin Laden is a blip, just as Anwar al-Awlaki is a blip. By the time voters come to vote for the next president of the United States, what would matter most, I think, is the economy and his position on things to do with the Middle East. And therefore, on that issue, he was quite clear, and it's his electioneering. So coming back to the point, I was right with half of my analysis. I wasn't so right with the other half. And I say so right because I had predicted that there might be a compromise which would deter the Palestinian Authority president and Mahmoud Abbas to actually submit the bid to the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. As most of our listeners know, he did submit it with much glee and quite a few flash bulbs in the background. But what is interesting is that this is a long process, and I did mention that. It's not a question of I submit the bid today and the UN decides on it tomorrow. It goes to the admissions committee where it is at the moment, and it will take quite a few weeks, if not even longer, before the Security Council decides whether to recommend the bid or not. And this is the period that everybody is looking at in order to see whether a compromise, a deal, incentives, call it what you will, can be found to lure both the Israelis and the Palestinians back to the negotiating table.
Now, we hear phrases that I suppose are obvious in some way, shape or form, but we might not be familiar, like the quartet. Mm. You hear it a lot these days, but then sometimes you actually have to go, well, you know, what is that? Now, I believe it's the EU, the US, the United Nations and Russia.
Yep.
Now they, even amongst themselves in their senior diplomatic circles, struggled to make this roadmap over the next 12 months, didn't they? So what on earth, what hope is there for this process?
That's absolutely true. I mean, let me backtrack for a minute and then I'll come back to the issue of the quartet because I have some clear views on that, as you might well know, James. Let me backtrack by saying that if I were to ask myself, and I've been asked this by Al Jazeera, by BBC, by Premier Christian Radio, by many, many other presenters, what did the Palestinians gain from this submission? I mean, did it change anything on the ground? Of course it didn't change anything on the ground. And in fact, even if tomorrow the UN were to say, we declare the 194th UN member state, it's not going to change things on the ground either. The checkpoints would still remain there. The separation wall would still remain there. And the problems between Israelis and Palestinians would still be there. What I think this submission or application did is, one, it basically reflected the sheer despair of the Palestinian people at the fact that 20 years since the start of negotiations and since the Oslo Accords in 1993, nothing much has changed on the ground. If anything, things have gone from bad to worse. And therefore, there is so much frustration, so much despair, so much anger within the Palestinian rank and file that it needed ventilation. And this is one way of doing it. It's dangerous because if nothing happens afterwards, then there might be another kind of frustration. But that sense of despair is one reason that motivated Mahmoud Abbas to do what he did. The other thing is the amount of disappointment in the American role as an honest broker or a fair arbiter in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the fact that even the most moderate Palestinian leadership came to the conclusion that the Americans will never be able to exercise any kind of pressure upon the Israeli government. And I specify the government because the Israeli people are by and large supportive of peace and of a two-state solution. So in a sense, they realize that nothing is going to happen on the American scene, on the bilateral scene. And therefore, what happened is that they moved the goalpost from a bilateral goalpost to a multilateral one. In other words, they threw it up to the international community and said, look, we are people desperately in need of self-determination. Can you help us retrieve some of our historical land? And this is where we are now. Let me come to the quartet. The quartet includes, as you well said, the United States, the United Nations, the European Union, and the Russian Federation. Now, part of the problem with the quartet is that it has been pretty much obsolete in terms of taking any political decision. Until now, it's all been the American administration. Either the Americans can move things forward or they can't. And unfortunately, they haven't. And the quartet has pretty much been the tail, and it hasn't actually wagged the dog at all. So in that sense, it's been redundant. The other problem with the quartet is that the Middle East envoy, our own former Prime Minister Tony Blair, is almost, and I say almost, a persona non grata within the Palestinian leadership and people because he is viewed as being very biased toward the Israeli positions and therefore not somebody who could take on the objectively the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. So, where do we go from here? Well, the hope is that if the Security Council project collapses, and I would again think that it pretty much might do so in the next weeks and few months, then it would go to the General Assembly, where we would have a observer status in the sense of a non-member state where, like the Holy See, like Taiwan, the Palestinian Authority would have access to international organs such as the International Criminal Court, the International Criminal Court of Justice, etc., etc. However, it would not be a fully fledged member state yet of the United Nations.
And just quickly, on the Arab League that we haven't mentioned just yet, we can debate how toothless or how firm they can be, but what is their particular position?
Well, their position has been unanimously supportive of the Palestinian state bid. So at least they've managed to do that and agree upon themselves that they support this bid. And in fact, Qatar and Lebanon, who are on the Security Council at the moment, helped a lot in terms of pushing and promoting this bid. However, I smiled, as you just saw when you said the Arab League, because I agree with you. It's pretty much toothless. It's pretty much disparate in its political influence and its political orientation. And I think the Arab League at the moment is more window dressing than anything else.
Is there anything we can say? I mean, there's a lot of negatives here, we have to be honest, and a lot of political maneuvering and that sort of thing. But we are, at least the eyes of the world and the eyes of many bodies representing different countries, are having this as their sort of number one central issue when it comes to foreign policy. That's got to be a good thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's one of the things that the Palestinian leadership and some of the Palestinian people who support this bid, and by and large they do, although there are reservations, particularly from Hamas and people who are sympathetic to the Hamas position. But one of the things that Palestinians would tell you is, all other things being equal, at least we pushed once again the Palestinian agenda to the forefront of the Middle East, North Africa reality after it had somehow disappeared since the popular revolts and revolutions started in Tunisia, Egypt, Syria, Libya, Yemen, Bahrain. So now there is a reinvigoration of the political realities of the Palestinian people, and people are once again coming to realize that the rules of the game are pretty much changing across the whole region, and that without a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian problem, there will be no peace in the Middle East and North Africa, and in fact, there will be no peace in Israel either, James.
Clearly, we're going to be coming back to this one, and in a sentence, or even in a word, if that's how you feel, Harry, with the quartet's call for a negotiated peace by the end of 2012, is that doable?
I doubt that that's doable, because we've been there so many times in the past. We've set dates, but they haven't worked. The only way it would become doable is if the new blueprint, the new proposal, has teeth in terms of defining what borders we are negotiating about, defining the framework of how long it would take before we actually get to a solution. Otherwise, what would then kick in terms of consequences if they fail to get a solution? And the third thing is, we also have to deal with the issue of settlements, because as you well know, and as anybody who's been to the Holy Land knows this, the longer it takes for Israelis and Palestinians to negotiate on the shape of a future sovereign Palestinian state, the less land there is to talk about. And that affects all Palestinians, Christian and Muslim, but it also affects Israel, because at the end of the day, whether both peoples accept it or not, and I think they largely do, they have to live side by side, and all it takes is some political will to do it, which is unfortunately lacking in some circles more than in others.
Well, we'll keep our eye on it, Harry. Now, again, it's that time that I think is a great joy, which is where I can sit back and listen to you having your 3 minutes on the MENA roundup. Because obviously, Harry, you know, on a serious note, we've got Syria still as an ongoing concern. Libya, I mean, you know, where is Gaddafi and so forth? Yemen, there are some of the Gulf states. There are plenty of things to talk about. And I am literally going to give you, be as succinct as possible, 3 minutes to give us a
roundup. I promise. It's not my want, but I will be succinct. Syria worries me a lot, James. The killings have increased, although we don't hear much about it. Doctors, university lecturers, other people are also now part of those who are getting killed. However, there is a sense of hope that the Syrian National Council came together in Istanbul, which consists of opposition leaders across the board. So you've got religious and liberal people, people like Muhammad Riyad al-Shaqfa from the Muslim Brotherhood, people like Burhan Ghalioun from the liberal side of political spectrum in Syria, who will then provide an address for the West and for all those who want to speak with the opposition to go and speak with them, pretty much like what happened in Libya previously. Libya, the two places that are still resisting the National Transitional Council are Sirte, the birthplace of Gaddafi and where his main Khadafa tribe live, and also Bani Walid. But I think gradually Libya is becoming clearer and clearer that we're coming toward the end of the Gaddafi rule. Yemen, there are clashes in the hundreds of thousands between those who support President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who returned from Saudi back to Yemen, and the Al-Hashid tribe, particularly the Al-Ahmar clan, who are against him. So it's basically the country is evenly divided between two forces. And finally, also, let's not forget that there have been troubles in Bahrain as well. So if we look at all this, and I'm coming to the end of my 3 minutes, I know, James, if we look at all this, we realize that what has happened, interestingly enough, and this is very important for all our listeners, we're no longer talking about a Middle East, North Africa the way we understood it before and we dealt with it. And I hope that the Mandarins and the Foreign Office would get this. We're no longer competing between a secular liberal agenda and an Islamist agenda. What we are competing with across the whole region is a struggle between a moderate Islamist future for the region, a little bit, if you want, like what we see in Turkey, or a much more conservative version like what we see perhaps in Iran. And the outcome of this struggle is going to determine the political shape of that whole region, and within it, all the Christian communities that are pretty much lost between supporting the regime as a way of protecting themselves in the future and joining the protesters on the streets.
Dr. Harry Hagopian, take a bow because you actually stuck to 3 minutes just about there. So that's fantastic. That is Harry Hagopian, who is the Bishop's consultant on the Middle East, with some top analysis there. Thanks for your expertise, and we'll join you soon.
My pleasure. And hope to see you after my next set of travels, probably end month or early next month, James.
Fantastic. Thanks, Harry.